Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence, in every sense of the word, I've come to admire greatly, as well as his courage and his articulate, passionate advocacy for our Constitution and our commitment, among other things, to religious freedom and, well, liberty more generally, is our first guest. His name is Dr. Zudi Jasser. He is a medical doctor by training, very accomplished at that, served as a medical professional in the United States Navy, rising to the rank of lieutenant commander, served on Capitol Hill in the attending physician's office for our members of Congress. He is, however, perhaps best known these days as an author and as an activist on behalf of moderates in the Muslim community. He has written a book entitled A Battle for the Soul of Islam, a very important text about the American Muslims' experience and the challenges that it faces when confronted with adherence to the ideology that I think is best described as sort of Sharia supremacism. He has some other terms for it, but we'll visit with him about all of that. But we're going to talk with him about his own story and challenges and efforts, but also a very controversial nomination that has been made by President Biden. He has now come out together with other moderate Muslims, opposing very forcefully, and we appreciate the chance to visit with him about all of this. Dr. Jasser, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you, sir.
Oh, thank you, Frank. It's always great to be with you. Appreciate it.
Remind us a little bit about your background. I've given some of the highlights, but how is it that you, first of all, came to be in the United States, and second of all, what prompts you to feel so passionately about the need to protect this remarkable experiment in freedom?
Well, thank you. You know, I'm the son of immigrants that sought the political asylum here in the United States in the mid-60s. My parents escaped Syria in 66 after the Ba'athists, who are basically the Arabist fascist sort of Nazis of Syria, if you will, and that became the Assad family party after 1970. But when they came here, I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, was born a few months after they got here. And growing up in Wisconsin, I learned a version of Islam that my family taught me that was very personal in a small mosque and a personal relationship with God. Then I went to the University of Wisconsin and was exposed to the Muslim Student Association and all these Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups. And I got a quick, fast study in what the Muslim Brotherhood was and how a faith that I thought was a personal pietistic faith was actually a political movement, was actually a movement that included a global campaign fueled by petro-Islamic dollars to build mosques, to spread organizations that weakened the West, that felt that anything outside of Muslim-majority countries was Dar al-Harb, or the land of war, and anything inside was the land of Islam to be run by their theocrats and their tyrants. And as a result of my grandfather's history of being in and out of prison in Syria, fighting for freedom, I thought there was nothing I wanted to do more than serve in the U.S. Navy. I served 11 years after a medical school scholarship. And as you said, I was blessed to have been able to be a physician to Congress. Then I moved out to Arizona, joined my dad in practice and primary care. And 9/11 happened. And all of a sudden, I saw folks representing our community blaming Israel, invoking conspiracy theories, and these were all imams and leaders. And we realized that we needed to form an organization, and we formed the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, whose mission wasn't just to counter terrorism, which is a symptom, but to counter the root cause. And to anyone who's sentient and rational and honest, the root cause of all of these groups, from Al-Qaeda to the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, to the Khomeinists of Iran, all of the root causes, basically the fact that Islam has not gone through an enlightenment. It needs deep reform, and it hasn't separated mosque and state and defeating sort of the establishment of religion through government and through its theocratic Sharia states. So our organization's mission is to separate mosque and state and advance liberty through that mechanism. And since 2001, I've engaged in debates against imams. I realized that we had to target Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups like CARE and ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, and others. And through that public work and public platforms, I've been able to become, I think, a spokesperson for a number of other folks and organizations that we formed an umbrella group called the Muslim Reform Movement, of more diverse groups that are not only conservatives, but liberals and feminists and others. And Senator McConnell appointed me in 2012 to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which was an unbelievable opportunity to really face some of the leaders in these countries that are Muslim majorities and expose how complicit not only our State Department has been, but how complicit some of our policies have been in actually allowing them to stay into power and advancing their Sharia operation.
That's a fabulously succinct and yet comprehensive description of how you came to be really in the forefront, I think, of this, well, you call it Battle for the Soul of Islam. Your subtitle of your book is also very important. An American Muslim Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. You are up against long odds, I think it's fair to say. While you have said, and I believe you're absolutely right, large numbers of American Muslims, at least, and probably a majority of them, are like you, people who did not want to live under Sharia. In some cases, as I think was true of your parents, they came here to get away from Sharia, in fact. They love the freedoms of this country, its constitution. Many of them, as again, foreign-born American patriots. They have an appreciation for what this country has to offer that most of us take for granted, if we understand it at all. But when you talk about the challenge that you're facing, the battle for the soul of Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization has a very considerable advantage in terms of infrastructure, in terms of imams and mosques, and you've had some experience with mosques being taken over by these guys as well. Talk a little bit about that dynamic and how it impacts the lives of moderate Muslims like yourself throughout this country, day in and day out.
Yeah, there's been a synergy for a long time between the rulers and tyrants, monarchs and others in the Middle East that really try to figure out how to stay in power with this grassroots Islamist movement. That's a viral populist movement that from one year to the next, and the Islamists are sort of the pet of the dictators, like in Egypt. To the next, they put them in prison and try to get rid of them. We saw this with Assad and Mubarak and the Saudis, in order to help, for example, Europe, their answer to help Europe with the influx of millions of refugees from Syria was to say that we'd help build hundreds more mosques, which is no way to help Europe with their problem, which is an ideological influx of folks that don't like Western life, that want to push in Islamism for the plurality, and the majority may not do so, but
the mosques as vehicles for inculcating that kind of Sharia supremacist doctrine in the immigrant population and the native Muslim population as well. No?
Yep. Erdogan says that the minarets are spears, and they are that there is no moderate Islam. There's only one Islam. And the Erdogans of the world said democracy is a train. You take it to where you want to get, and then you get off, as he's shown in Turkey. And at the end of the day, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in the West is an ideology that has dominated our community. While, you know, maybe perhaps a majority of Muslims don't believe in their ideology, but in America, what they do when they don't, they just don't go to mosque and they stay home and do their jobs and take care of their families, and they don't do much else. But what I see is that even though there might just be 4 or 5 million Muslims in America, which is barely over 1%, it's not that they're going to take over America, but what they can do is we have a responsibility to affect the rest of the world. And we could be a very potent, not only thorn in the side, but a head of the spear against political Islam ideologically. Because if you look at most of the publishing houses globally of Islam, 99% are fueled by this Sharia supremacism, where the interpretation of Islam on the Sunni side are one of the four radical sects of Shafi'i and Maliki and Hanbali, and all those interpretations are the same, basically, that you kill those who leave Islam, you cut the hands of those who steal, you abuse and torture women, control their bodily autonomy. On the Shia side, you have the Khomeinists, Hezbollah, and others basically putting the same type of political Islamist doctrine. The non-Islamists don't have publishing houses, don't have the institutions, and that's really what we sought to do with the American Islamic Forum. Now, having said how outnumbered we are and how we're not part of the establishment, every time we debate them, they lose. That's why I can't get any more debates with imams, because every time we've done so, the 95% of the audience leaves and says, oh my God, this imam not only doesn't understand Islam, he doesn't understand America, he doesn't understand freedom and liberty. So they will lose. And that's why when you appoint somebody to be an ambassador of international religious freedom, I get it that they're trying to put more Muslims in place of influence to show that America is diverse. But for crying out loud, it should be somebody who's ready to take on the mantle of freedom and counter the Islamists. I mean, in Britain, you had a homeland.
Let me ask you to pause on that point, Zudi, because I do want to introduce one of the reasons we were very anxious to talk with you is Rashad Hussein is a man who has, in fact, just been nominated by President Biden to become that individual, the man who is our ambassador at large for international religious freedom. We, in the capacity of our work with Save the Persecuted Christians, have sought answers from him to a number of questions that were not put when he appeared briefly before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee a month or so ago. But you and your colleagues in the Muslim reform movement have now come out very forcefully in a statement issued earlier this week, really denouncing this individual and opposing strongly his nomination to this position. So drill down a bit further on that. Why is it so important that a person who is very much, it seems, with the Sharia supremacist program, a Hafiz of the Quran, as he's called, having memorized the entire Quran, is not a good fit for this job, especially knowing what you do of this international religious freedom challenge that we have in the United States government and around the world?
Yeah, I think this is so important, Frank. I mean, I try to memorize the Quran. As a devout Muslim, I believe it's the word of God, but what lens do I look at it through? And the lens that I look at it through is one based on my American centrality of freedom and liberty and the need to reform most of the interpretations that those passages are used to interpret, to look at. And Rashad Hussein, you know, when I was on the Commission on Religious Freedom, we went to Saudi Arabia 3 times, went to Egypt, went to Indonesia, and every time we met with feminist groups, we met with groups that were dissidents. And even though Rashad was in some of the same countries at the same time, he didn't want to cross paths with us. Because after our meetings, I would sometimes meet with the Saudis and express to the State Department how our own translators were intentionally mistranslating meetings because they didn't want diplomatic unrest, because Jasser would come in and sort of expose what the reality is of the lies being told by the Saudi government or the Brotherhood. When we went in 13, the Muslim Brotherhood was running Egypt. Imagine if Rashad Hussein, who sat in, on his hands and said nothing as an envoy to the OIC, was the ambassador to religious freedom at the time. Not only would we have welcomed the Muslim Brotherhood like Ambassador Peterson did, Patterson did, but he would have also then somehow declared them to be ambassadors for religious freedom in Egypt, which is complete nonsense. And the reason I know this, he never took them on. He, as much as it might be hard, and he scrubbed the internet of all of his proclivities to support political Islam, he has never taken them on. And if you're going to be representing Muslims and be such a sort of beacon for American Muslim freedom, you have to have a pedigree of having taken them on. He's had so many opportunities to do that. He never has. From the India-Pakistan area with the Jamaat Islamiya groups to Iran, to Saudi, to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. He has never given speeches that talks about the true core cancer of radical Islam being the Sharia project of Islamic states as being the root cause. And to me, that means he's a liability. To me, it means that if he's appointed, it'll send a signal to the groups that support him. By the way, look at also who's supporting him. At his feet in press releases are CARE, the Muslim Student Association, Islamic Study North America, all clapping and cheering him on as their son from Plano, Texas, who's now going on to be the ambassador for religious freedom. He's going to be the ambassador to allow the Islamists to advance their project. He's going to send a message to the Erdogans and the Irans of the world that America now has completely taken a hike on pushing for any pressure for reform and helping dissidents like groups that we support at our Muslim reform movement of women's groups that are abused and tortured in Tehran, or the Christians or atheists or others that are in prison in Saudi Arabia that need to be released, like Raif Badawi. He never articulated support for Raif Badawi in Saudi Arabia instead of just sitting there at the OIC at those meetings he went to.
Let me just drill down on that for a moment. Zudi Jasser again is our guest. Dr. Jasser, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation is, by some accounts, kind of a modern-day caliphate. It is made up of 57 nations, or in the case of Palestine, a would-be nation that have in common a sort of Muslim majority and basically Sharia supremacist caste. Is that fair? And as our envoy to that group, how did he comport himself, Rashad Hussein, and as you say, not just with respect to the things he didn't do or say about religious freedom on behalf of, moderate Muslims, apostates, as they're called, people who've left Islam, as well as Christians and Jews and other persecuted by Sharia supremacist Muslim types, but also what he did do with them. Was he not involved in supporting the sort of Sharia blasphemy project of the OIC during his time there?
He certainly didn't have any qualms with it. He certainly, you remember, you're exactly right. The Obama administration at the time gave not only lip service, but Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, and then Clinton after him, spent hours of American taxpayers' time under the rubric of diplomacy to try to hear that somehow we needed to control speech and not criticize Islam, which is the exact Islamophobia project that I wrote about at the Center for Security Policy this week about what Ilhan Omar is trying to do with her bill. But at the end of the day, Rashad Hussein never took that on and actually allowed us to remain on defense. So his position was not only simply to be sitting there listening, but was actually to cater to the interests of the theocrats and their sense of wanting to put the West on defense so that we were apologizing and trying to show that we weren't anti-Islam or anti-Muslim Brotherhood or all these other things, which basically allowed them to have whatever agenda they wanted, ignore human rights, ignore protection of religious minorities, which I think speaks more than anything on how unqualified and unfit he would be to be an ambassador for religious freedom. Fine, he has freedoms to do whatever he wants politically, that's fine. But to put him into this position is the wrong person at the wrong time.
I personally very strongly agree with that. And we most especially want to make sure that the Senate is informed of all of this. Your position, that of your fellow moderate Muslims in the Muslim reform movement, the work you do at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy is indispensable. Dr. Jasser, we very much appreciate it. And I think these cautionary notes, much as our own efforts at SaveThePersecutedChristians.org to ask Rashad Hussein questions that would establish just how unsuited he is for this position, all need to be very much part of the mix when the Senate decides whether to consider this nomination, let alone approve it. And I want to thank you for, as always, the courage that you've been exhibiting in leading in opposition to this domination and trying to make sure that we don't make a terrible mistake. Thank you, Dr. Jasser, for joining us today. I hope you'll come back to us soon. Check out A Battle for the Soul of Islam, an American Muslim Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith, and the work Dr. Jasser does at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. Thank you, sir. Come back to us again soon, if you would.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are joined by one of our favorite regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He has served his country in a number of important capacities as an army officer, as a clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. He has been a candidate for Congress. He's the author of a number of terrific books, including a nonfiction work, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is, these days, the driving force behind an indispensable online resource, andmagazine.com. He's also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. We're always delighted to have him aboard with us to talk about the things he's focusing on at And Magazine and with us at the committee and more. And Sam, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir. Good to have you.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you very much.
Pleasure is truly ours. Sam, you have been doing some really important writing and work on the vaccination issue. And I'd like to sort of pick your brains a little bit about this. We are now being buffeted by competing characterizations of a variant known as Omicron, which we're told is emanating from southern Africa. And by some accounts, it's highly transmissible, potentially very dangerous. And in the face of that threat, everybody must get vaccinated again and again and again, evidently. If you have been unvaccinated to this point, you must get vaccinated. If you have been vaccinated twice with the jab, you must get boosters. And perhaps there will be pills and other things in the offing shortly from Pfizer and Moderna, I guess. What are the prospects, Sam Faddis, based on your research and consultations with serious medical practitioners in this virology space, that we can contend with this particular variant, or for that matter, a pandemic caused by any number of its further iterations, COVID-19, that is, through vaccinations, particularly of the kind that we're now calling vaccines, which are really just gene therapies, are they not?
Yeah, well, I mean, the short answer to your question is that the prospects are nil. I mean, this is one of the last things we wrote at End Magazine was talking about how inside out this world has become, because you have Fauci running around decreeing that he now is science, literally word for word, I am science, and imposing what really is more akin to a medieval version of religion and theology. And this is the dogma, this is theology, this is the doctrine, thou shalt not dictate, or maybe you're going to be burned at the stake, and it doesn't matter what the facts are. I mean, the fact is that the virus mutates so rapidly, and the immunity you get from the vaccine, if we call it a vaccine, is so narrow that very rapidly as the virus mutates, the vaccine they gave you has no utility whatsoever against the new variants. And you can see this in practice, right? As soon as this whole Omicron thing dusted up in South Africa, which is, you know, kind of a tempest in a teapot, the most vaccinated nations on earth, like Israel, locked down and shut their borders to travelers from South Africa. So they have forced everybody to get vaccinated. And yet as soon as there's a new variant, they're terrified and don't allow any, and are trying to seal themselves off, therefore acknowledging factually that the vaccines don't work, while at the same time Fauci is telling everyone there will be no deviation from the requirement that everybody must get vaccinated, and that's the only way out of this. What we've now gone into is a strange world. I mean, there are other elements to it in which what they're imposing, I don't think any longer qualifies as science. It qualifies as some kind of religion where you're just required to believe despite what the facts tell you.
And Sam, the thing that I guess is so troubling about this is that it's not just that these vaccines won't work against these new mutations. There are potential very considerable risks associated with them, it seems, especially if one continues to intensify your exposure to them through boosters. And I think it's predictable that the booster that is now on offer will not be the last booster. We will see in another few months, either with the pretext that there's some new variant or simply that the booster's effectiveness is wearing off, that you have to get jabbed again. What do you know about the likely risks associated with these vaccines that makes this strategy of just, continuing to pump people full of them all the more problematic?
Well, again, to start with, using the term booster is itself an attempt to conceal the reality of what's going on, to make you feel like the original vaccine remains effective in some fashion. It's not a booster, it's another vaccine. I mean, as each variant appears, they have to keep creating a new vaccine to address that. But as you indicated, there's a mountain of evidence, first of all, that people are experiencing adverse reactions of all sorts in massive numbers to these vaccines, in numbers far in excess of, in the past, when we've approached anything like this, we've never approached anything like this, but when we've had numbers far less than this, adverse reactions, we have completely shut down the use of vaccine historically. That's happened many times. So we're simply ignoring those adverse reactions and pretending like they don't happen. Then there's the impact on the virus itself, because you're not acquiring natural immunity, this broad-based immunity that will protect you against future variants. The virus is in effect driven to mutate and find ways around these vaccines. And each time it does that, each time it reinfects and re-spread, there's the potential for it to become much more dangerous. Now, there's also a potential to be clear that it mutates in a way that makes it less dangerous and, in fact, essentially burns itself out. And that may, in fact, be what's actually happening with Omicron. That would be the good news. But the other direction is also equally possible. So there is speculation amongst folks who know their business. In fact, there have been scientific publications, very reputable publications, relatively recently talking about the possibility that we may drive this thing to mutate to the point where it has something like a 30% fatality rate equal to smallpox so we take something that really, realistically kills primarily elderly people with extensive comorbidities for the most part, and turn it into the equivalent of smallpox because what we're doing is not scientifically based. What we're doing is we're requiring you to get vaccinated. I mean, part of that is control and part of that is just greed, because that's the only way we're going to get out of this, because that's the only way Big Pharma is going to make $1 trillion out of this.
Well, they seem well on their way to doing that, needless to say. And the prospect of new pills or new boosters or new vaccines, for that matter, all mandated, would put them on that track for sure. And I was struck. You had a quote in your piece at End Magazine the other day about all this, entitled "One More Time with a Big Red Crayon: You Cannot Vaccinate Your Way Out of the Pandemic." A quote from Dr. Robert Malone, a man who is going to appear on our television program this weekend, to the effect, he says, quote, "The Biden administration's strategy to universally vaccinate in the middle of the pandemic is bad science and badly needs a reboot. This strategy will likely prolong the most dangerous phase of the worst pandemic since 1918, and almost assuredly cause more harm than good, even as it undermines faith in the entire public health system." And I think that's where we increasingly are at this point.
That's dead on.
Sam, let me turn to one other topic that we visit with you from time to time about, and I just feel it's so important, the book that you're keeping on what the Biden Harris administration is doing with respect to the source of this disease, the Chinese Communist Party. Of course, in the recent summit with Xi Jinping, President Biden didn't see fit to bring up this unpleasantness about the virus, nor China's responsibility for it, let alone the idea that it should be induced to pay reparations to the rest of the world, including an awful lot of Americans, for what it has done to afflict them. But there's also this larger concern, which you've documented extensively in your section on the Manchurian administration and at accountabilityinitiative.org, namely the degree to which members of this administration, from the president on down, are really deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and the impact that's having on American policy. What can you give us in the way of an update on that score? Because it's so vital to our understanding of the challenge we're facing from China on the one hand and the response that we need to make from here.
Well, you know, I think the important thing for people to understand, and we've explored this before, is that if you look at the Bidens, Hunter Biden and Joe and so forth, in their context of the Communist Chinese, now that people are beginning to some extent to discuss it in the media, there's a lot of focus on the salacious, and there's a lot of focus maybe on just sort of the element of corruption and selling influence. What is still being missed, in my estimation, is the real heart of this and the most dangerous element. The Chinese, as you well know, operate a worldwide operation under the rubric of the United Front Work Department, which is specifically focused on going out and pushing Chinese influence in other countries, and includes as a specific element of that something they term elite capture. So elite capture means going out, co-opting, buying, getting control of, recruiting in intelligence parlance, the elites of key foreign nations, well, maybe not even key nations, all nations actually, so that they will then do the bidding of Beijing. So this is not fantasy. It's not science fiction. It's well documented. The U.S. government has written about it. U.S. intelligence agencies are focused on it. And operatives of the United Front have not only been identified, but in a number of cases, many cases, actually convicted and sent to prison all over the world for going out and buying foreign officials to do the bidding of Beijing. If you look at that and look at the individuals involved and look at the template, and then look at the contacts between the Bidens and the Communist Chinese, there's no question, no reasonable question, in my opinion, about the fact that that's exactly what you're looking at. That this is not just some shady Chinese businessman doing business with Hunter. This is the Chinese buying access, and they're not buying access to Hunter, who's a cokehead with no discernible skills. They're buying Joe Biden to the tune of billions of dollars, and this goes on over the course of a year. Now, that guy has clearly, at a minimum, been their target and has accepted very large quantities of their money, is sitting in the White House. That to me, is all fact. Now, if you don't therefore think that this is a significant national security question as to whether he is currently doing the bidding of Xi Jinping, then I think you're just deciding to ignore the obvious. And of course, as far as I know, and I think my access is pretty good, nobody in the American counterintelligence apparatus is doing anything about this. They might be hunting for the possibility that there's GS-15 at Commerce who works for the Chinese. But the possibility that the guy in the Oval Office works for the Chinese is simply being ignored.
So for all these reasons, Sam, we appreciate enormously the research and the analysis that you're providing these days, primarily at andmagazine.com. Of course, in your appearances with us and Steve Bannon in the War Room and elsewhere. And I know you'll keep it up, and I hope that you will continue to have a growing impact with your explanations of the dangers that we're facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is a man I've known and admired for quite some time. We haven't had him on this program for altogether too long, so I'm delighted that he's back. His name is Bruce Klingner. He is former Central Intelligence Agency's top specialist on North Korea and has been for many years one of the go-to guys for the Congress, for the media, for us here at Secure Freedom Radio, for insights into what is going on in North Korea and the implications of its military ambitions and the political situation on both sides of the demilitarized zone, for that matter. He specializes in all of these topics at the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior research fellow for Northeast Asia in the foundation's Asian Studies Center. And you can follow him, as I do, at Bruce Klingner on Twitter. Bruce, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for joining us once again, and welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
I wanted to sort of talk through with you a problem that has been sort of emerging in the House of Representatives at the moment. It involves a piece of legislation called H.R. 3446, Peace on the Korean Peninsula Act. Nobody could object to that principle, but the question is that what would come of it? Before we get into the details of that bill, I would like to, as I say, kind of calibrate with you. What is the state of North Korea at the moment, its military, and particularly how it's postured that might make peace on the Korean Peninsula not exactly a promising prospect?
So along with having numerous nuclear weapons, North Korea has missiles that can range not only all of South Korea and Japan and our critically important bases in Guam and Hawaii, but the entire continental U.S. And they showed that with some ICBM launches they did earlier. Along with that, they have conventional forces that are forward and offensively deployed close to the demilitarized zone, close to South Korea. So over 70% of their conventional forces are forward deployed within striking range of South Korea. And then something that I've really delved into recently is their cyber capabilities. Many people think that, well, this little country that can't seem to keep the lights on at night couldn't possibly be a cyber threat. And actually, they are. For years, the U.S. And South Korea have said North Korea is in the top four countries of the world that are cyber threats. And when I really delved into it last year for a research paper, I was astounded by what North Korea had done with cyber. They, over the years, they've done cyber espionage. They've done cyber bank robberies. Some are estimating getting $800 million to $1 billion a year from cybercrime. They've gone after cryptocurrencies and all the like. They've gotten into infrastructure websites such as nuclear power plants, even web systems in South Korea that can regulate the speed of trains in South Korea. So not only is it certainly a threat and a risk right now, but you know, think in terms of a crisis or a war on the peninsula, the things that they could do, not only espionage, but cyber attacks, even undermining the confidence in the international financial system. So it really is kind of an amazingly broad and deep threat to the United States and its allies from a country that's only some 25 million or so people.
An underlying reality in all of that is that the 25 million people, the vast majority of them at least, are suffering enormously to maintain and grow and utilize to varying degrees these various military, cyber, intelligence, and other capabilities on the part of the North Korean regime. Is that not right?
Oh, exactly. It's perhaps the most repressive regime in the world today. And several years ago, when a UN Commission of Inquiry looked into North Korean human rights, they assessed that the human rights violations were so widespread and systemic that they constituted crimes against humanity and that they were violations not seen since Nazi Germany. The people are suffering. And when you see pictures of how emaciated they are, and we learn of the human rights violations, you know, it's awful. And they blame sort of natural conditions or weather catastrophes. But really, it's decades of the socialist government-driven economic policies, which, you know, have brought them to the brink of collapse and almost beyond. And they brutally repress any kind of perceived threat to the regime. Some Americans, when they've gone over, have been arrested for, one person left a Bible behind in the men's room of a bar, and that was seen as a threat to regime stability. And he was given several years at hard labor in a penal institution. He eventually was released early. But, any kind of not only direct criticism of the regime, but even just being a Christian in North Korea is seen as a threat to regime stability. So it's really a brutal regime. And when we see how poorly off the people are economically, many will blame the international and the U.S. sanctions. But you know, there are no sanctions against food and medicine and humanitarian assistance. And the U.S. and South Korea and others have repeatedly offered rice and medicine and COVID assistance. And it's the regime that's always rejected it.
And when it has been provided, I think it's fair to say it generally has wound up going to the regime, to its party cadre, to its military, and not to the millions and millions of Koreans who are in desperate need of such humanitarian assistance, right?
Right. So some will get to the people, and it depends on how well it's monitored. And the U.S. would provide food through the World Food Program, a U.N. organization. And North Korea and the World Food Program had an agreement years ago about sort of the level of monitoring and verification. And then when North Korea wouldn't abide by it, well, then that's when the aid stopped flowing. There some aid will get to the people and food or medicine. Others will. We've had reports that the bags of rice that were given to people during the day and monitored, well, that night the military would come knocking on the door and say, well, turn it over to the military. And also, aid is sort of fungible. You know, if you give the aid, even if it goes to the people, well, that frees up resources that the regime may have otherwise had to spend on the people. And now that they can be spent on the military. It's, you know, if I give you $10, well, that can either go to food, or that frees up $10 that you did have for something else that you wanted to spend on.
Let me turn from the sort of image of population with, among other things, stunted growth from the privations that have been imposed upon it, to say nothing of the barbaric, inhumane control of the people of North Korea in order to maintain this forward deployed and immensely dangerous North Korean military machine, the fourth largest in the world by some accounts. And I understand about 70% of it is in proximity to the demilitarized zone at any given time, meaning Seoul, which is pretty much just on the other side of it, and the rest of South Korea is very much in peril from these guys. Talk a little bit, if you would, Bruce Klingner, about the policies of the government of South Korea at the moment. Its attitude has been described by other guests on this program as being willing to achieve reunification with the North on the North's terms, if necessary. Is that an overstatement, or does that sound about right under the policies of Moon Jae-in?
I would see it as the Moon administration being overly eager and naive in its approach to trying to reconcile and improve relations and restart dialogue with the North. So Moon is a liberal, progressive, left of center, however you want to describe it. And progressive administrations in the South have consistently pursued a policy which has been referred to in a previous administration as the sunshine policy. And that's a reference to an Aesop's fable where the sun and the wind compete to get a man to take his coat off. The wind blows and blows, and the man only tightens his hold on his coat. And the sun shines and gets the man to take off his coat. And the idea, when applied to North Korea, is that North Korea feels threatened, and therefore, if we were to reduce our own military posture, if we were to reduce military exercises, et cetera, as well as provide many benefits without any conditions in the beginning, then North Korea would feel reassured and therefore start to act like a normal nation. Well, I disagree with that. It's sort of like giving money to a bank robber to induce him to stop robbing banks. So what Moon has done is, like previous liberal administrations, is offered a long, long, long list of economic benefits. Now, unlike in the past, now international and U.S. sanctions preclude those kind of transfers. So South Korea can no longer provide billions of dollars of assistance to the North. And because of that, Moon is looking for other ways to try to, in part, secure his own legacy as a peacemaker on the peninsula. So he's looking for different things. He's trying to induce dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea and South Korea with North Korea. And that brings up his latest initiative is an end of war declaration. And he's trying to get the U.S. to go along with that. So I think it's just a, you know, they will turn a blind eye to North Korean human rights violations. They will acquiesce to North Korean threats and insults and, you know, have a very non-conditional or unconditional approach towards the North, all in an attempt to not only improve relations, but at this point, even just to restart dialogue.
I want to come back to the end of war declaration here in just a moment, but just staying with the Moon policies, Bruce, when you look at this set of concessions or the belief that, you know, if only we were nicer to the North Koreans, they would behave better. Is there really any basis in historical experience that suggests that that's true? Is this just, you know, again, the kind of delusions that the left often engages in? Or is there some realistic prospect that the regime, which, as best I can tell, still vows to achieve the reunification of the peninsula by violent means, by invasion, is actually susceptible to any of these kinds of inducements?
We've tried many inducements in the past, and they haven't worked. Some will say, well, sanctions haven't worked. Let's try something totally new and try dialogue and providing various benefits. Well, we've been trying that. We've had 8 international agreements with North Korea on denuclearization, the first 4 of which they promised never to build nuclear weapons, and then the second 4 to give up what they promised never to build in the first place. South Korea has had 253 agreements with the North, not all nuclear. They've provided billions of dollars in various forms of economic or humanitarian assistance. We've tried security guarantees and, soft power, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the only consistency is that North Korea continued to build up its nuclear and missile arsenals and continued to subjugate its people. So, you know, it's not to say we don't try another agreement, but hopefully we learn from the lessons of the past and have one that's, you know, better written with stronger verification. But
we still shouldn't be under any illusions that the will to fulfill these kinds of commitments is not much in evidence, which brings us to H.R. 3446, as I say, the Peace on the Korean Peninsula Act. Bruce Klinger, as a longtime observer and analyst, dissector of what is the policy of the North Korean government. Is there reason to believe that were an agreement fashioned in some manner with them to create an end of the Korean War that has effectively been accomplished by the armistice, but not legally, that this would be met with a good faith dismantling of its military in the North and the threat that it poses to the South, do you think?
Well, as you pointed out earlier, how can you be against peace? It certainly sounds like such a great idea, but it's how you do it. And so after following North Korea for many years, I'm cynical and skeptical, but willing to try things. But if you look at both the U.S. legislation, which is sort of a product of pushing by South Korea and as well as other advocates, as well as President Moon's push for an end of war declaration. You know, it sounds, you know, fine. How can you be against it? The Korean War officially is still going on 70 years later. We haven't had major hostilities. We've had lots of acts of war and terror, but not major hostilities. Why not simply sign a piece of paper and say the war is over, and why not have that be a way of initiating dialogue? Well, there's a lot to unpack. So what I find interesting is when Moon administration officials and others that I've talked to who advocate an end of war declaration, they, on the one hand, will make very grandiose claims as to what it will accomplish. President Moon said it'll create a new order of reconciliation and cooperation and make irreversible progress on denuclearization. One of his senior officials said it'd be a driving force for real peace and a catalyst for dialogue. And yet, on the other hand, in order to try to get the U.S. to sign it, they sort of highlight its uselessness. They'll say, look, it's just a really simple diplomatic only piece of paper. It really has no effect on the real world. Why not sign it? And I said, well, for that very reason, if it has no effect on the North Korean conventional threat to the South, why would you do that? You need to address the causes of the threat to peace rather than simply signing a document. So we've had the armistice for 70 years, but it really was the strong presence of South Korean and U.S. forces which enforced that armistice by deterring North Korea from doing major hostilities. So, there's things, it would be a very simple, basically, the war's over, you know, get three or four signatures on it. And it legally would have no impact on U.S. forces in South Korea. But, you know, it would create momentum, not only within North Korea and China, but amongst progressives in the South, as well as in the U.S. of, oh, if the war's over, why do we have troops there? Why do we have a promise of extended deterrence? Why do we have a mutual defense treaty if the war's over? Well, then once you start reducing U.S. commitment to the South and U.S. forces there, who knows what could happen? But it's a slippery slope that I see as very dangerous. Without any benefits from a document that wouldn't address the North Korean threat.
Bruce, you've written a very thoughtful paper about this subject entitled End of Korean War Declaration Could Have Serious Consequences for Alliance Security. And it brings me back to something we talked about a moment ago. The policies of the Moon government seem to me to make it, well, absolutely predictable, really, that this agreement, should it come to pass, would translate into insistence from the Moon government, especially, again, as you said, given its determination before the end of this president's term next year that he has some lasting achievement in the peace portfolio to point to, that he would, in fact, say, hey, we no longer need these troops. The alliance can be modified or truncated, I guess, because we now have this arrangement with the North Korean government. I shudder at the thought of that because it does seem to me, as you've indicated, that this would be a very tempting thing for the North, given its proclivities, given its, again, stated policy to achieve through force the reunification of the peninsula. It bears our close scrutiny, which, of course, you're providing at the Heritage Foundation, Bruce Klinger, but it also, I think, argues very strongly for opposing efforts to create conditions that really could conduce to a second Korean War, not peace, on the Korean Peninsula. Bruce, I hope you'll keep us apprised of how this is developing and more broadly, really, what we need to be thinking about with respect to the North Korean government and its various threats to our security and that of our alliance as key elements. Keep up the great work at the Heritage Foundation, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then,
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.